Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Late last week, John Kasich did what GOP candidates have been wary to do in this campaign for president. First, his super PAC started running a TV ad going after Donald Trump. That sparked a Twitter war where Trump called Kasich, quote, a complete and total dud and, quote, a total failure. And yesterday on Meet the Press, John Kasich blasted Trump for his willingness to make Muslims register.
I've been in a virtual war with Donald Trump over these things. I flat out condemned the idea that we were going to have Muslims register. I mean, I can't help it that maybe you didn't have a camera out there. But the fact is, I condemned it as soon as it came out of his mouth.
The Trump-Kasich tussle is topic one on the Monday Reporters Roundtable. Joining us today, Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Jim, welcome.
Good morning.
Mark Kovac, State House bureau chief for Dick's Newspapers and The Vindicator. Mark, welcome.
Happy Thanksgiving week.
Yes. And Jackie Borchard, State House reporter for Cleveland.com.
Thanks for having me.
Mark, we'll start with you. Is this a dangerous game for John Kasich? Could it backfire?
Oh, I suppose it could, but he needs attention. He needs his name out there. He needs people talking about him, and he needs people like Donald Trump, who's leading in the polls, talking about him. So especially today, as Donald Trump comes into his backyard for, I think, his first appearance since the Republican debate. Am I wrong on that?
I think so. I think it is his first Ohio campaign stop.
So, I think Kasich needs to show that this is his state, his people, and, he's got to do something to get himself out there. He's kind of trailing in the polls at this point.
I mean, Jim Siegel, he's really taking advantage of Trump's appearance here. There's no coincidence here that he's going after him the weekend before he shows up.
Well, yeah, I think it's smart. I mean, like you said, candidates have been a little hesitant to go after Trump. But really, the latest, Washington Post, ABC News poll has Kasich at 3%. He is way behind in trailing most of the other candidates. So what does he have to lose? And really, it has shown that when people do tussle with him, Trump tussles back, and it does raise the profile of whoever is fighting with him at the time. And it is good timing coming right as Trump is about to step into Kasich's backyard. And I'm guessing that Donald Trump will have a few choice words for Governor Kasich during his speech this evening.
No such thing as bad publicity, I'm sure. Jackie Borchard, there's a tailgating going on down there at the convention center where Trump is speaking, and it's all Republicans getting their protest ready.
That's right. We're in, Kasich's backyard, so he's got his friends at various events throughout the day. There's, I think, a phone call this morning with some state legislators and Congressman T-Berry to kind of, have a pre-buttal to whatever Trump is going to say tonight. And then later this afternoon, we have another Kasich event, sans Kasich, with Tom Moe and some other veterans. I think Congressman Steve Sivers is going to be there, kind of giving, I guess, a veteran's perspective on Trump's presidential agenda. And then, those are the Republicans. And then you also have your run-of-the-mill anti-Trump faction. You've got, some immigrant advocacy groups, some labor union groups, and, people who typically show up to protest the Trump events.
You throw in the heartbeat bill people who are also planning the protest, who are not happy with Governor Kasich for not moving a ban essentially on all abortions. So you throw them in the mix, and we were talking before we went on the air, do the Democrats protest this? And if they do, who do they protest? Because
they really don't need to. They can just sit on the sidelines let the Republicans fight it out. Yeah. But, Jackie, there has been among the sort of the Tea Party supporters in Ohio, there's been an anti-Kasich undercurrent. And this is who's going to show up here tonight, I assume.
Oh, absolutely. A couple months ago, the Koch brothers had an event, a Liberty-themed event. You could call it a Tea Party type event in Columbus. And that was also seen as kind of a jab at Kasich because they invited several Republican presidential candidates, and Kasich was not among them. You had Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Rick Perry even at the time. And, everyone I talked to there was really excited about Donald Trump. And, everyone was saying how they wished Trump had been there. And, they really liked what Trump was saying. Not hardly any mentions of Kasich. And these were most people from Ohio, but also from, other states as well.
But there are also some people who in the Republican establishment who are really not excited about Donald Trump. In fact, they're scared to death that he is actually going to get the nomination. I mean, that poll I mentioned earlier, Trump's leading with 32%. Ben Carson at 22 is the next closest. No one else is over 11. And so this is actually turning out to be a little helpful for Kasich in fundraising. His super PAC says that they have now collected significant money from 10 major donors who basically with the understanding that he's going to use that money to attack Trump.
And these are donors who may support other candidates.
Right.
Correct?
Yeah. It doesn't necessarily mean they want they're looking around going, OK, who's willing to battle with Donald Trump and try to knock him off the pedestal? We'll go help him. And then we'll try to then we'll get behind whoever we want to, you know, to get behind once the more establishment candidates start to rise up and we'll sort it out at that point.
So what is John Kasich in his super PAC? I know they don't talk officially, but what is the thinking here that, you know, by damaging Trump, the establishment candidates rise, maybe we have a chance there? Or is he going for VP here, trying to gain favor with the other establishment candidates who may finish ahead of him and may get the nomination?
I mean, I've heard that theory floated that he's maybe trying for the VP. I'm not sure I agree with it, but I don't know. I just don't know if that's what's in his back of his mind or not. But I haven't heard any indication that is what he's angling for. I just think you know, Donald Trump for someone like John Kasich, Donald Trump offers up a lot of rhetoric that he can take shots at and disagree with him on, and even in doing so, Kasich will not come off sounding like some squishy moderate. I mean, Trump takes some pretty right-wing stances on things, you know, wanting to, you know, keep mosques under surveillance and that type of thing and register Muslims. I mean, when you're talking about doing that kind of stuff, it's not too hard to step in and take some shots at that kind of thing. And I think that's kind of where he just thinks it's going to raise his own profile by doing it.
I don't know if Kasich's been asked recently, but he's been adamant about not wanting to be vice president and that not even being in the cards. And now at the same time, about a year ago, Kasich was adamant that he was totally focused on Ohio and wouldn't even comment on the presidential race. But I guess I wouldn't be totally shocked, but I'd be surprised if that's what he was vying for.
Nobody at this point is going to say, yeah, I'll take number two if it's given to me. They're still going for number one at this point. We're talking John Kasich, Donald Trump, the presidential campaign, as we lead off the Monday morning reporters roundtable here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann. We welcome you to join the conversation. 292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Jackie, getting back to this, he's got nothing to lose. He can go after Trump much more. It's a less of a risky move than, say, Marco Rubio going after Donald Trump at this point. So he's willing to take up that mantle. He has the personality to do that. I mean, he's got this sort of in-your-face, straight-talk, almost attack dog personality.
Yeah, and we definitely saw that over the weekend. Kasich was on some of the Sunday news programs, and I think it was Meet the Press, where he really called out these poll numbers that show that Trump is leading the way. And I think he even said, you know, do these people even exist? These people who are supporting Trump, but you know, and I think he said, I don't think so. I don't think this is but kind of like, is this real life? I think he has the personality to go after it. And like you said, nothing to lose at this point. And, you know, his campaign up all along has been focused on New Hampshire. And I think, you know, New Hampshire voters are different than Iowa voters and South Carolina voters. And I think this plays into that strategy of if he can knock Trump further back, then there's, you know, room for him to move up.
But Mark, we're going to get an idea of who these voters are because there's thousands of people going to show up at this Trump rally today, whether they get the 15,000 they expect. But there's not going to be a small crowd there.
No,
in the Greater Columbus Convention Center.
They're supposed to be a big crowd. I think I read in the Dispatch this morning that tickets are, well, they're not sold out because they were free, but they're all, 15,000 have been given out. It will be interesting to see what kind of protesters make it into the building. There's been a lot of video over the past week of people shouting and, you know, causing a scene at some of these rallies. One guy getting punched, I guess, over the weekend. It'll be interesting to see that and to see how they control those of us in the media. Trying to cover those things.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Also late last week, John Kasich took a rightward turn when it comes to foreign policy. First, he in the same speech at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., it came out that he, along with all the other Republican governors, wrote a letter to the president saying, you know, no more Syrian refugees until the refugee screening process can be tightened up. And then John Kasich said, in that Meet the Press speech, that he supports consolidating various State Department communications agency into one agency that promotes Judeo-Christian values around the world. And he took some heat for that, backed off a little bit, but that was no accident, Jim Siegel. It was prepared text when he read that speech. He mentioned Judeo-Christian values several times in that speech. He's mentioned it many times as governor. What do you think is going on there?
Well, John Kasich has always been very upfront about his religion and its impact on his life and how it guides him both personally and as governor. And it's not surprising to me that he wants to continue to interject that as he's running for president as well. There's definitely a segment of the Republican base that really warms up to that kind of thing, and that's helpful to get that out there and let people know that I'm just not a Johnny come lately when it comes to this or when it's convenient. It really is a big part of my life. Talking about creating this this agency of spreading Judeo-Christian values. I mean, he tried to kind of clarify it a little bit and said, you know, we want to talk about spreading ideas of freedom of speech, freedom for women to be, active in society, and
freedom of religion, which I thought was kind of ironic when you single out two as your
right. And the thing I thought about is that, okay, but these are not necessarily things that you have to have tied to Judeo-Christian values. These are more, it sounded to me more like democratic themes, like
Western themes,
Western democracy themes, more than a Judeo-Christian theme. And so I think he could have gotten away if he just didn't try to link the two, if he could have just said, we want to, because I don't think there's a disagreement that he wants to say we need to win some of these battles of ideas. We can't just win the battles of bullets. But I just think he would have avoided some of the controversy had he not linked it directly to some Judeo-Christian agency.
There were several times during that speech, though, that he talked about Judeo-Christian values. He also talked about moderate Muslims being part of this bigger push to get Western values out and to understand. So I don't know if it's just Kasich not expressing himself very clearly, but moderate Muslims were a big part of that speech.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I find it ironic that during that speech he says, I'm not going to apologize for saying we want to promote Judeo-Christian values. And then the next day he didn't really apologize, but he certainly backed
it back,
off. It.
Yeah. I think that phrase was what was most problematic. Like Mark said, in the context of the speech, I think it was more clear his point of, bringing Western values. And I think the other part of that was problematic was the word agency, because even among conservative Republicans, you say, wait a minute, you want to create a new government bureaucracy to do this? And he also later walked back that statement and said, well, no, not a new additional spending item per se, but using what's already there to do that work.
Consolidate the agency,
right?
He wants to do the refugee issue. I mean, majority of Americans in the polls say we should do what these Republican governors want to do, and that's stop the flow of Syrian refugees into the U.S. until refugee screening is tighter. If we can make it tighter, I don't know. What's going on here, Mark Kovac?
Well, there's a lot of fear over what happened in Paris, and the idea that at least one of these folks came into France through a refugee process. There's a fear that that's going to happen here. There's probably also a lot of misunderstanding about how the refugee process works and the vetting that's already involved. But people are rightly afraid when gunmen are walking into a concert hall or something and shooting people dead. The last thing we want to see is that also happening here in our country. So, I mean, it's understandable. Not that the governor or any governor has the authority to stop, I suppose, the refugees from coming into their state. Mm-hmm. And we have, refugees here in this state from Syria, too. So,
now, earlier this, I think it was in September, John Kasich was on Fox News and he was asked about this after President Obama said we would accept 10,000 refugees. He said, yeah, they should come in, and there's no way you can stop every single bad person if they want to get into the country. But this was definitely a change after the Paris attacks, Jim Siegel.
Right. And it's because, like Mark said, it's about, what just happened in front of us, and is, there's fear driving some of this. Like you mentioned the poll, it was that Washington Post poll, 54% said we should not accept them, 43% said we should. I didn't see the breakdowns. I'm guessing that breaks down pretty heavily on party lines, which way you're going. But I just wonder how many folks, and this includes people in the Ohio House who debated this last week, a resolution asking the president to block refugees, how many of them actually understand the process? I mean, it's just like an 18 to 24 month process of processing a refugee to come into this country. And I looked it up today. I just want to get a brief. I mean, they start off with the UN High Commission for Refugees. That's their first contact. Then they're vetted by the National Counterterrorism Center, the FBI Terrorist Screening Center, the Department of State, the Defense and Homeland Security Department. Then they get their fingerprints taken. Biological information is taken. And then they are each individually interviewed by U.S. officials trained to verify that they're bona fide refugees. Now, do I know whether this process actually works? I mean, this is what's written on paper.
Yeah.
Do I know if – no, I can't say for sure. But I don't know.
It's a lot different than what's going on in Europe right now.
Right. But I'm not sure that anyone who's standing up yelling we shouldn't accept refugees, I don't know that they know either. And so I think it's – you know, we need to have a more calm, rational discussion about this, I think, than just the knee-jerk kind of fear-based reaction we've had so far.
And Jackie Borchert, there are – Democrats have also signed on with this. This isn't strictly Republican. There were a couple of congressmen, congresspeople from Ohio, Democrats, who voted with the, the House and wanting to – put a moratorium on this. Ted Strickland even said, you know, wasn't quite as strong as John Kasich, but he said, you know, maybe we should pause and wait, make sure we assess the screening process.
I think that's the easiest route to take after, you know, an attack like that. I think it's definitely a reaction to what happened in Paris. And no one, you know, while people here are very, you know, afraid, heightened fears because of that, it's hard for someone to say, oh, no, just, you know, bring them all in. I don't think, you know, anyone's going to say that. That wouldn't be a popular position. So I do think politics plays a lot in this. And like Jim said, you know, what is known, what is publicly known? I mean, there's a whole bunch of, I think, within those steps, things that we don't know and can't know because they're, you know, measures of national security, and they should be things that aren't published in the newspapers. But I think in the last couple of days, I've seen those steps outlined at several news organizations on websites and in newspapers. So I think maybe we might start to see the tide turn a little bit as people learn more about actually what that process entails. I think that the first step is that Jim said, you know, these refugees don't choose to come to the U.S. They are selected by the U.N. to come to go to whatever country they go to. And I think that's a huge misunderstanding. And anyone who wants to come to the U.S. to commit acts of terrorism, I mean, are they really going to sit around and wait 2 years? That's, yeah. You know, I just think that as more information becomes available, you'll start to see, you know, more nuanced positions on this. I think that was more the, you know, initial knee-jerk reaction.
Okay, when we come back, we'll talk about state house politics, gun regulations in the news at the state house, also Planned Parenthood back in the news at the state house, when the Reporters Roundtable continues on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to the Monday Morning Roundtable on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Jackie Borchert from Cleveland.com is here. Mark Kovac from the Dix Newspapers and the Vindicator, the steady hand behind the shaky video. That's Mark Kovac, if you check out his YouTube channel. And Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. At the State House, or near the State House, underdog Democratic U.S. Senate candidate P.G. Sittenfeld is using gun control to try to gain an advantage over his rival, Ted Strickland. Strickland is a strong supporter of gun rights, earning an A-plus rating from the NRA a couple of years ago. Sittenfeld goes the other way. To some degree, he proposes more comprehensive background checks, closing the gun show loophole, banning military-style assault weapons, and also some other regulations. Jackie Borchert, P.G. Sittenfeld trails Ted Strickland quite a bit in the polls, name recognition, money, the whole nine yards. But this is an issue where he really could, among Democrats, make hay with Ted Strickland.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's why, you know, he came to Columbus for this event to, you know, draw the attention of the State House press corps and hopefully get his message out statewide. And it is, like you said, a very clear area where he can separate himself from Ted Strickland. But I think, you know, he's so far behind. I don't know if this is, you know, this is such an important issue for especially Democratic voters that they would feel the need to switch their, you know, votes if they were planning on voting for Strickland.
This race cracks me up because, you know, we went over to PG and heard him and got his comments. And then we approached the Portman campaign and the Strickland campaign. And, you know, PG said this about you. What do you think? And the two other campaigns completely ignore PG and attack each other. So it's what do you think about what PG Sittenfeld said? Well, you know, and Strickland will say, Rob Portman voted for this. And then Portman will say, well, Ted Strickland did this. And PG is not even in the discussion. So it's just fascinating to me that he, I mean, he's trying.
Yeah. I mean, it's can you win? Oh, I mean, there's a reason why Ted Strickland is pro-gun rights. First of all, he grew up in Appalachia, which is basically a stronger gun rights or part of the state. So he probably has some personal feelings that gun ownership rights should be maintained. But there's a lot of part of the state that Jim is conservative and supports the NRA, supports gun owners' rights. Can you win statewide on PG's gun platform?
I think you can, because I don't think his platform, his gun platform, is that far to the, you know, that far to the left.
No.
I mean, he's talking about some of the biggest issues that gun control supporters have been talking about for years. I mean, background checks, you know, the closing the gun show loophole. I mean, these are generally not considered, even among a lot of gun supporters, these are not generally considered to be really controversial topics.
Yeah, I think the majority of gun owners support the stronger background checks,
right,
at least.
Exactly. So if he sticks to just kind of the big, you know, the big non-controversial topics when it comes to trying to provide some more safeguards with guns, I think he's okay. But you're not going to get too much further on that before you really start running into some problems with a lot of parts of the state.
But does it show a little bit of a change in politics? And even these relatively modest gun control proposals, Jackie, are now talked about on the campaign trail. We saw Hillary Clinton go after Bernie Sanders on his gun record. Now we're seeing PG. Granted, he's way behind. But, you know, 10 years ago, you know, Democrats lost the House because of the assault weapons ban in Washington. And they, for 10 years, you didn't talk about guns at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, that in the past just 18 months, you've had so many well-publicized acts of gun violence and mass shootings. And it's a really sad truth, but people pay attention to those when you see all of a sudden your news channel turns to another mass shooting in progress. So I think that as a whole, Americans are kind of, anytime they see something like this, I say, well, what can we do? I mean, what can be done? And so I think it's natural that becomes a topic. I think it is interesting, though, that you see the Democrats, especially, you know, Hillary and Bernie. I mean, that's a place where they can draw a big division. And so I think it's natural for that, but even more so because of the rise in profile of mass shootings.
Something PG, I thought, did pretty effectively in his speech was, OK, you've got this loophole and that let this individual get this gun to do this atrocity. And then you've got this loophole over here. And that's what ended up this person, that's how they got their gun. And that's how, so he had some real world examples of how these loopholes or how the law is set, you know, what the effect that they had. So I thought that, I mean, that was an effective part of the speech. I don't know that it's going to sway Second Amendment folks.
Meanwhile,
who would say, you know, well, if more people had guns, they could have shot those people coming in to shoot the other people.
Which leads to my next question, Mark, is that meanwhile at the State House, where the House chose to loosen concealed carry restrictions to allow guns at daycare centers, airport terminals, and even police station lobbies.
Yeah, I mean, the way this works is that bill would take those places automatically off the list of places where firearms are restricted. I got that right, don't I? And so those places still could decide not to allow concealed carry.
Put a little sticker in the door window.
Doorway or whatever. You know, the other thing is it would lessen some of the penalties against carrying a concealed firearm if you're a permitted individual on a college campus. And the example that was given from the floor is, you know, hey, what if you're walking down High Street and you don't even realize you're on campus and you get, you know, taken aside and ticketed or something. So there's some loosening restriction language in there. It's an interesting bill, but it was a more interesting process from the floor where there was essentially no debate and it went through very quickly.
And Democrats, I assume, not happy with that, Jim.
No, Democrats were very upset that they didn't get the chance to debate that bill, but not that it would have changed anything about the actual vote. But they didn't really the speaker did not give the sponsor of the bill got up and spoke, sat down, and then the speaker said, you know, called the bill and then looked around to see if anyone was standing to talk. He didn't see anybody. He says, you know, and then he called the vote. And, you know, there's the speaker obviously has a lot of discretion as to how long he waits till somebody stands up, because and look, folks aren't just sitting there waiting to jump up sometimes. I mean, sometimes they are, but particularly at the beginning of the debates, they tend to have an order, you know, okay, which one of us is going to speak first, who's going to offer which amendment. Sometimes it just doesn't go as smoothly, and maybe, you know, the speaker has to wait a couple more seconds before one of the Democrats gets up. But that didn't happen, and so he called the vote, and Democrats weren't happy. But, you know, it like I said, in the end of the day, it wasn't going to change anything about about the bill passing, which is now it's now in the Senate now.
So Jackie, is there a strategy here where gun rights advocates keep loosening the restrictions, so if there's ever a time when the restrictions are starting to get watered down, there's just more of them to water down? Or is it just why do we keep – I mean, we have concealed carry. They're trying to change the training requirements and everything else. It just seems like at some point, why is it just like all Wild West, everyone carry a gun and be done with it?
Why not? It's your Second Amendment right. I think we have a very – the House is – the House and the Senate are both controlled by Republicans. You have more conservative Republicans than you've had, 5, 6, 7 years ago. They go home to conservative districts, and loosening gun regulations is something that they can put in their letter to constituents to say, look, I'm, protecting your Second Amendment right. I'm, doing away with government bureaucracy. And I think there are, they back this up with anecdotes like Mark mentioned about walking down High Street and being on campus. That sounds very, reasonable. Like, well, why should I get ticketed if I'm just, happen to be on campus? But, we didn't hear the other side of that debate during the House vote. I'll be interested to see what happens in the Senate and how they handle that bill going forward.
Is it also the fear of the NRA? Say you are a strong gun rights supporter. You believe in the Second Amendment. You believe that people should be allowed to carry handguns. But you say, you know what? I don't think they should be in daycare centers. I don't think they should have guns in bars, which we saw passed a few years ago. But even voting against those small provisions can bring out, an even stronger supporter of gun rights who would attack you from the right.
Right. One of the issues has been on this gun issue for a while now has been that the supporters, the NRA supporters and the hardline gun rights advocates, which includes folks like the Buckeye Association for Firearms Association and others, they care a lot more about this than the people who you describe who say, well, maybe I don't think that's such a good idea. And that's just been the case. The folks who are in favor of these types of measures that we've seen pass that have loosened up the restrictions over the years are much more passionate and much more likely to vote because of it than the people who are against them. People who say, well, I'm a Second Amendment supporter, but I don't necessarily think that's the way to go. Those folks just don't speak up, and they don't tend to. And the way the elections have gone, they doesn't show that they are willing to change their vote over the kind of thing. So it's the passionate side continues to win out, and that's going to continue to be the case until we see something otherwise.
The lawmakers who don't want to increase regulations on guns often say that we should improve our mental health system so that folks who are mentally ill get the help they need and don't act on violence. Jackie, where's that bill right now?
What bill?
Is there any movement? We keep hearing that when they say whenever one of these shootings happens, we say we got to do more to help our mental health system, but yet we don't see any legislation anywhere, whether the federal level or the state level.
Right. At the state level, I think you have a lot of lawmakers who point to efforts within the corrections department to reduce their recidivism rates. And you also see the expansion of Medicaid. And also they point to, I believe it was the last budget, they put some extra funding in for mental health. And it's something that I think, at least in Ohio, we have to address mostly through a budget or a budget corrections bill. There's no standalone bill in the Ohio State House.
But as you mentioned, the Medicaid expansion did bring a lot of mental health services to lower income folks. So that is one thing that the governor pushed through. The legislature really didn't want that to some degree, but the governor did it. We're talking with our reporters roundtable here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Join the conversation, 292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mark Kovac, Planned Parenthood. The House voted to defund Planned Parenthood last week. It's similar to a bill passed in the Senate, so this looks like it's on its way to happening where all state funding for Planned Parenthood will go away.
It's my understanding. I think they're identical now. I think the House amended its version to match the Senate version. So the Senate passed its version. The House passed its version. It's obvious that lawmakers in both chambers support the move. Now it's figuring out which one's going to move. I would guess it's going to move. I would think it's going to move before the end of the year. We still have a couple of sessions left. But this is a bill that would block funding in certain program streams from going to an abortion provider or someone unaffiliated with a group that gives abortions. So it's interesting. In the House, the sponsors and the proponents will say, well, Planned Parenthood is not mentioned in this bill. If you go over to the Senate, Keith Faber, who's the primary sponsor, in his testimony said this bill is for Planned Parenthood. So, I mean, it's pretty obvious what we're talking about. I think we're talking about $1.2 million total funding.
So what does that mean for Planned Parenthood? Will clinics close because of this?
No, it's really a drop in the bucket for their overall funding. But what this money is specifically target, it goes through certain streams for specific programs, some HIV testing programs, some sexually transmitted disease testing, a program that helps educate foster youth about personal responsibility, sex ed, and some other things. So these are not like, it's not going to close a clinic, for example, but it will have an impact on the areas where they have these programs. And the bill also prevents public health departments and even the state health department from contracting with Planned Parenthood to provide services. And that's also something that they do. It's like a school district, for example, instead of doing their own sex ed, we'll call up the local Planned Parenthood and say, hey, can you come in and do this? So that won't be allowed either by this bill.
Jim Siegel, doesn't affect federal funding that passes through the state because that's controlled by the federal law.
Right.
And this money, the $1.5 million is supposed to go to other organizations that don't perform abortions to continue this. Are there enough organizations out there?
Well, there's always big numbers thrown around as to the other organizations out there. The question always is, do they really offer the kind of services that Planned Parenthood offers? Is it a direct comparison? And that continues to be part of the debate. But it's just hard to say. I have not looked into it enough to know. But, I mean, there are a number of other types of clinics that this will go to and types of agencies. But, frankly, it's not that much money. Yeah. I mean, even if there are other services, a lot of this debate is over the principle of the thing and the fact that this is cutting off a stream of funding that isn't going for abortions. But going for other services, and the Republicans argue, look, we understand that, but look, if you want this money, if you want our support, just stop doing abortions. Mm-hmm. We'll be happy to do it. But this money, if we're gonna take a stand against abortion, then we're gonna make sure that only the money we give out only goes to providers that don't do it.
Mark Kovac, Democrats are already, they've been criticizing this all along. Is there any chance, I mean, the State House is so gerrymandered that it'll remain in Republican hands, but like for statewide candidates, Rob Portman being the next one up, can Ted Strickland, assuming he's the Democratic nominee, could he make hay with this and say, Ohio is just anti-women, the war on women thing?
I suppose you could, and you could also throw out the infant mortality rate for the state, which is very high, and at a time when Republicans in the State House are also trying to combat infant mortality, you have a bill like this where the opponents are going to come forward and say, hey, look, these programs are helping reduce infant mortality and you're killing kids, essentially. So, that's something very well could come up in a statewide race.
All right. Thank you to Jackie Borchardt from Cleveland.com, Mark Kovac from the Dix Newspapers and The Vindicator, and Jim Siegel from the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks for joining us here on the Roundtable. When we return, we'll get a look at the national economy, low gas prices, but possibly higher interest rates. We'll see what that means for the U.S. economy coming up next on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The good economic news keeps rolling in. Ohio's unemployment rate is down to 4.5%. That's the lowest it's been since 2001. Gas prices are at less than $2 a gallon just about everywhere. Consumer confidence is up, but still wages remain stagnant and poverty rates remain high. Joining us on All Sides with Ann Fisher is NPR's senior editor for business and economics, Marilyn Giewax, a proud alum of Ohio State, and as you heard, still in mourning a bit from Saturday night. Marilyn, welcome to
Hi.
89.7 on all sides.
I'm so glad to be here. I appreciate a chance to come back to Ohio State.
Of course, the big question in the economic news right now is, what is the national economic impact of the Buckeyes' loss to Michigan State on Saturday?
It's all we're talking about. Economists across the world are discussing that yet.
Anyway, so there are some encouraging signs. I mentioned let's talk about the thing that we see every day when we're driving to work. Driving to school is the gas prices. I mean, $1.89. I think I paid $1.79 this weekend when I filled up. I mean, it's incredible how low they are. Why are they so low right now?
Well, it is amazing, especially here in Columbus. I've been shocked by how cheap the gas is. I went on gasbuddy.com this morning to think, is this just my imagination? But actually, Columbus is particularly low. I think it has to do with refineries. I'm not exactly sure why you guys are so cheap. But I actually thought about comparing gas prices from, say, 40 years ago, from the 70s when we had the gas crisis. And it was about when you adjust for inflation. Gas was much cheaper. Is much cheaper today.
Wow.
Like way cheaper than it used to be, you know, even before we ran into all these energy problems. So what we're really seeing is this global experience of overproduction and underutilization of oil. I mean, oil use is still growing, but just not at the rate that it used to be. And a big reason for that is the shale formations here in the United States, in the Dakotas, in Texas. All of these new sources of oil have come onto the global market, and the global economy has slowed down. And now we're seeing, especially in Europe, the economy really seems to be slowing. China is much slower. So as the growth in oil use slows down, the production continues to be huge, and that's driven prices down. You know, a couple of years ago, oil was selling for about $140 a barrel. Now it's about $40 a barrel. That's a phenomenal change.
And it's amazing. In the past, you know, the tiniest little bit of instability in the Middle East would almost immediately shoot gas prices up. I mean, Middle East now is so unstable. I mean, but gas prices are going down. That old causal relationship is just not there anymore. Is that because of the oil is being produced at so many other places now besides just Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Iran?
Well, that's the thing, is those 70s prices that I was looking back on, when we had the disturbances in the Middle East, when there was an oil embargo and reasons there that caused oil to spike, everybody talked constantly about OPEC and what was happening with Middle Eastern oil. Now, you know, it's just diminished in relative importance because of these new sources of oil in North America and in other places around the world. These new technologies for extracting oil, this so-called fracking, it's a different kind of drilling. It's a horizontal method that results in the ability to bring up a whole lot more oil. So we're really seeing these low prices. It's hard to say how long it lasts, but there's two things happening at once. On the one hand, you have the global economy slowing down, and then you have these new sources. So that meets together with cheap gas.
What does it mean for the overall economy? It has to have, I mean, psychologically, when you fill up your tank and it only costs you $30, where a couple of years ago it was costing you $70, that has to, at the very least, boost consumer confidence, because we're all doing it every week.
And think about this. Also, gasoline mileage is so much better. You know, if you go back and look at cars years ago, you get 10 miles to a gallon. Now there are a whole lot of cars out there that get 30 miles to a gallon. So not only is gasoline cheaper, but you can go further with it. So its relative cost to workers has really diminished quite a bit. So that does act as, in effect, a giant tax cut on the whole country. People have more money in their pocket to spend. But, you know, consumer confidence seems to be being affected by lots of things. People had, shall we say, a debt overhang. The recession was really bad. People had a lot of credit cards, student debt, home equity loans. So far, this money that's showing up in our wallets has not particularly gone to a new surge in consumer spending. It's been more whittling down our old debts. So it gives reason for economists to be sort of optimistic, thinking that eventually we're going to turn this corner, especially with gases falling as much as it has recently. So, you know, there may be a lot more money in our wallets. And suddenly, you know, a week before Christmas, we all decide to spend it.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to tell if people are going to allow sort of global jitters about this situation with terrorism to make them more conservative, or will there be a burst of spending?
We saw our food prices rise during the time when gas was $140 or oil was $140 a barrel. Will we see food prices come back down again?
Yes, actually, in the most recent CPI, you know, the Consumer Price Index, as we look at food prices, price increases were really quite tame. And in fact, the producer price index, that's the wholesale prices, what's in the pipeline, showed pretty dramatic drops in prices. So you're really seeing some relief for the consumers at the grocery store as well. And just one good example of that this week is turkeys. You know, we had that avian flu this summer. You may have heard about millions of turkeys were killed. And that was really, you know, kind of a real blow to the turkey industry. But that avian flu hit primarily at the heaviest, biggest birds. So it was more for the turkey sausage, turkey bacon, the deli meats. But the turkeys that were eating for Thanksgiving are a little bit smaller, and those turkeys weren't as much affected. So instead of seeing a surge in prices that I think a lot of us were expecting, you know, you go to Walmart and turkeys are selling for, they said, I called Walmart and they said the average 16-pound turkey is actually down by 64 cents from last year to $17.44 for the national average. So that's really quite, you know, they're really some bargains out there on food.
We're talking about the national economy with Marilyn Giewak. She is NPR's senior editor for business and economics here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Join the conversation 292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Unemployment 5% nationally, 4.5% here in Ohio. How close are we to what economists think is full employment? Are we nearing that number?
Well, let's just take a moment to think about that 5% national number. Mm-hmm. That is for October of 2015. October of 2009, the unemployment rate was 10%. 10% is like horrible.
Yeah.
You know, double digits was, I mean, that was a really bad October in 2009. So to cut the unemployment rate in half has been really quite remarkable. But one thing that is bad in that, or well, two things I guess are bad in there. One is the labor force participation rate has dropped off. But, you know, a good portion of that, at least a third of the number of people who have dropped out, have to do with baby boomers retiring or maybe a little bit of forced retirement.
Yeah.
I know as a baby boomer journalist, some of my friends lost jobs at newspapers and they really have kind of eased out of the workforce. They're just not coming back. So they are retired, but maybe they retired sooner than they would have liked.
Maybe working part time,
right,
picking up some consulting work,
a little freelancing
writing.
Here and there, but they're not really employed. Mm-hmm. So they've dropped out of the workforce. And then there are a lot of people who lost jobs in mining, extraction, manufacturing. If you're a coal miner in West Virginia and you lost your job, as many have because of the shift away from coal, it's pretty tough to be in your 50s and be a coal miner. You're pretty beaten up, really.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of factory workers, you've had a hard job, you've had a hard life, and now you're trying to re-career at a time when that's not very realistic. So a lot of people have just dropped out of the labor force. So that's a real problem.
So that number is quite a bit higher than, say, it was a generation ago?
Right. If you took, you know, if we had the same labor force participation that we had you know, a decade ago when more baby boomers were in the peak of their earnings years, the unemployment rate would be higher than 5%. But, you know, it is what it is. I mean, if people have moved out of the labor force, then, you know, we are really at 5%. So many employers are actually having a tough time filling positions. Mm-hmm. Truck drivers particularly are an area where we could use more workers. But the other point I was going to make about the labor market, the reason that people feel pretty bad about it is wages really haven't risen. So even though it seems kind of strange that on the one hand we're talking about pretty much reaching full employment, that you know, where there are employers and workers are pretty much evening out, that you're never going to get to zero unemployment because somebody is always going to lose their job. It takes a couple of weeks or maybe a couple of months to find a new position. So there's always going to be some amount of unemployment. But we're reaching the point where we're almost at equilibrium between openings and workers. But you really still aren't seeing those wage increases. Lately, it's been improving a bit. But wages really have been a sticking point.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, that the consumer spending really hasn't picked up along with the economy because people have been paying off the debt that they accumulated during the recession. And usually wages start to rise. There's a lag between unemployment rate dropping and wages rising. Is it because of the recession was so deep that it's going to take a little while longer for the wages to – that lag between the drop in the unemployment rate and wage increases is going to be that much longer?
Well, that's the thing. In this country, there tends to be a stickiness to wages. Employers don't like to go to workers and actually cut their wages. You know, so even when times are pretty hard, employers will just tighten their belts. They'll lay off some workers. They'd rather lose people entirely than go to their workforce and cut wages, because that's a tough thing to face your workers and actually cut wages, because that hurts morale. It causes people to want to leave or retire. It's just it's a real downer to have your wages cut. So employers will stall when it comes to lowering wages, even though maybe their business conditions would suggest that they should be lowering wages. They don't do it. But then when things pick up, the employers feel like, hey, I carried you guys through the tough times. I've got to make up those lost profits. Mm-hmm. And so they're reluctant to give raises, especially if they're a little bit uncertain about the future of the economy. So in both directions, wages have been kind of stuck. They didn't fall as much as they might have, and they haven't risen as much as we would hope.
Is it also because the job, even though the unemployment rate is down, a lot of those new jobs are low paying, service jobs, retail jobs?
And that's another factor. You raise a good point there. A lot of what we lost in the recession, think about those coal miners I was referring to. Mining tends to be a union job, tends to pay well. Manufacturing jobs tend to pay well. And those were a lot of where the losses were. Construction. In fact, there was a phrase we used a few years ago about a man session, that men were particularly hard hit during the worst of the recession because those high-paying jobs went away. And now really what we have gained back has tended to be, you know, restaurants, hotels. I mean, people are traveling again. But those aren't the high-paying jobs.
Yeah. The Fed meets next month. Strongly expected that they will finally raise interest rates. What's the thinking? Is it a done deal, and by how much will they raise the rates?
Boy, you know, I keep changing my mind on what's the done deal. One minute you think, well, they're definitely not going to raise them, and then, oh, they definitely will. Well, about a week ago, the thinking was that they would definitely, absolutely raise interest rates in December. But now there are some concerns. Some people are doubting that because of the situation with Paris and the European economy. And it looks like if European interest rates stay super duper low, can we really afford to raise interest rates? If you think about that, if we have higher interest rates, people around the world will want to own U.S. treasuries because they will pay a higher interest rate than what you can get in a European market. But if everybody rushes in to buy those U.S. treasuries, that tends to make the dollar stronger. Well, that's the last thing we need right now, is a super strong dollar. It's already strong. It's hurting our corn farmers and the car producers. So the Fed,
it's harder
may,
for other countries to buy our stuff
when
our dollar
the
is
point.
Strong. Yeah.
When you have if you're trying to buy corn, wheat, cars, any of the things that we are producing, and you have to buy them with strong dollars, that's you're going to look elsewhere. Maybe you'll try to find somebody else to supply you, or you just won't buy those pork bellies.
But there's always something that can cause them not to raise rates. With unemployment as low as it is, and don't you have to bite the bullet at some point and say, you know, we can't have 0%?
Well, that's certainly the argument that the people who say we should have higher interest rates are. Why should you have no ammunition for the future? I mean, if something goes wrong, you don't want to have a Federal Reserve that can't cut interest rates. You want to give them a little bit of wiggle room so that in the future they have more ability to respond to crises. And also, keep in mind that really low interest rates can cause bad decisions. I mean, people will overinvest. In fact, one might argue that part of the reason that oil prices have fallen so much, and all commodities, copper, you know, iron ore, all of it has been falling because there's been too much investment. Yeah. So that's another downside of interest rates.
Well, we'll watch to see what the Fed does and how it affects all of our lives, mortgage rates, home equity loans, credit cards, and the overall economy. Thanks very much, Marilyn G. Wax, NPR's senior editor for Business and Economics. Thanks for joining us here on All Sides.
Oh, you're welcome. It was really nice to be here.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.